This is Lee.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com.
And the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipati.
Today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipati.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Welcome to TLU Vegas 22. Ben, I know you, Josh Koskoff, and Lloyd Bell did a whole presentation yesterday. You've got more today and more tomorrow.
Correct. Yeah, we had a great day yesterday. We had a full morning of medical malpractice lectures and then the afternoon breakout groups where we had 16 people and everybody got up and talked. They did sort of the, we call it the elevator pitch opening. So it's the 60-second version of your case where you have to tell people what happened and bring them into the case and explain to them why you should, you know, win. And then everybody in the room offered feedback, and it was great.
That can't be easy for people to do.
It's very hard. And, you know, you just realize how difficult it is to communicate something complex in a very short period of time, but also in a way that's engaging and compelling to people. And of course, when we go and do that for real and at trial, we've practiced it, we've revised it probably hundreds of times. So these are people just getting up off the cuff. But I think they got some really good feedback more thematically about where they should be going with the case, kind of big picture stuff. We're not obviously getting into the weeds at that stage. But, you know, helping people not go in the wrong direction early on, they're thinking about a case. How was your day? You and Sonia did voir dire with an actual jury pool. Did that go well?
Yeah, it went well, actually. It was a lot of fun. So we just kind of taught our philosophy of really focusing on cause challenges, making it a comfortable environment for jurors to actually speak their real mind, and then showing how it's done, and then showing how it's not supposed to be done. So I had a colleague at my office, Ian Sampson. He came, and then right after me, with the people I established cause on, he then did an old-fashioned voir dire and then magically rehabbed them all. So
you assigned the role of doing it the wrong way to somebody else in your office, is what you're saying?
Somebody volunteered. That's how I'm going to describe it.
And did you have somebody playing the judge?
No, we didn't have anybody playing the judge. So we just kind of got right into it, just time-wise.
So most importantly, that tonight is the famous TLU Halloween party. What will you be going as, Rahul? Wow.
So I did bring my costume, and it's Fred from Scooby-Doo. Oh. So I've got the blonde wig, the white sweatshirt with the orange little wrap around it, you know.
And you came up with that on your own, or did your wife help put that together for you?
Well, it was a 70s theme party also. So my 10-year-old and I, for my cousin's 50th birthday, this is really inappropriate, but I'm going to say it, okay? So my 10-year-old, he's so cute, but he's a little on the tiny side, right? And so I said, hey, buddy, Bridge is his name. I said, Bridge, we should do a joint costume together. And we should go as the guys from Fantasy Island. I want to be Mr. Rourke and you be Tattoo. And then he looked it up. And then he looked at me and he said, Dad, you're exploiting my height and I will not do this. And I won't stand for this. I'll be Scooby-Doo and you be Fred. And I was like, when I got exposed like that, I said, okay. So
there we are. That's funny you mentioned that, because my daughter, when she was probably about 8, was cast in the school play. in her elementary school. So we went to it and she only had one line in the whole play. And it was, "The plane."
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. And then, so
for like the next year, of course, she has two older brothers. Every time it would come up, the brothers and me, we just, "The plane." We're like, "Josie, you need to go recast that role you had, you know, your first acting role." Well, we're thrilled today to have Tanya Ortega on our podcast. I met Tanya in Los Angeles at the PSBR Trial College, and you were teaching there, and you're here teaching in Vegas. But before we get into what you're doing and teaching, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a trial lawyer?
So yeah, I'm so happy to be here. I love seeing y'all banter. This is really fun. So thank you for including me. I appreciate
it. You want to do some banter? Yeah. Let's do some banter before. Do you have a costume?
I don't, but I was thinking last night, what's the easiest thing I can do? And I thought, I can put on a bathrobe and run around with a white Russian and be the Big Lebowski.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know. I'm reaching, but that's what came to mind.
I think that would probably work.
Right? I don't know.
I really wish I had put the thought into getting the Elvis costume, because it seems like when you're in Vegas, it's just the right thing to do. But
dang, wow. There's got to be one to where someplace to buy one.
Actually, about 20 minutes ago up in my room, I was Googling Vegas costume stores. So
you were doing a lot of Googling. Doing
a lot of Googling today.
And it's early, y'all.
Ben's costume, though, this is pretty special. What are you going to be, Ben?
It's not the best version of it, but my plan is to be Axl Rose. The wig with blonde hair and the Guns N' Roses t-shirt,
yes.
The jeans. So
yeah.
Pretty simple, but, you know, Axl was a formative figure in my development, so I could have been Slash with more preparation, but I didn't get it together. Yeah. So tell us about you.
So let's see where to start. I practice in California, all over California, and pro hoc into other states where I'm not licensed. I'm also licensed in Illinois, but I live on the Central Coast with my family, and recently, about a month ago, I left my firm of 8 years, which was a beautiful experience, but for a few reasons, I just thought I needed to go out on my own. So I recently opened up my own firm, the Ortega Firm. It's definitely a family endeavor. We're all invested in it. And so we specialize in brain injuries and neurotrauma. So that's where we are right now. And how did I become a trial lawyer? I think the law found me initially. My folks and I think as a lot of people maybe my age, generationally, your folks have a lot of influence on where you go to school and what you do as a career. And so that happened to me. And I enjoyed law school. It was fine. Graduated and then went on the defense side for about 5 years in Chicago. And that was my first introduction into law and the practice of law. And I'll tell you what, y'all, that was tough. And so after 5.5 years, and I was in Chicago, I'm from Texas originally, it's cold. Yeah, I couldn't handle it. So after 5.5 years, I moved to California and my brother gave me a job as a medical sales person. I'm also not a salesperson. That wasn't really my jam either. But in that process, I met a plaintiff attorney and realized that in that practice, that's where my passion was. And so I got licensed in California, practiced with him, and then moved on to the firm that I was with previously. And we do plaintiff personal injury 100%. And I think what has really come out for me and why I love being a trial lawyer, and I love being an advocate for people who are injured and hurt and need help, is my purpose on this earth, and I think for a lot of us, is that we're healers. And we're healers in the way of getting folks justice, making things right that were wrong, but also healers in the sense of, how can we help you feel better? And how can I bear witness to what you're experiencing? So that is the fundamental part for me as a trial lawyer, what I try to bring to my practice and for my clients. So that's my story.
That's amazing. So how did you get into focusing on traumatic brain injuries and neurotrauma?
In 2001, my mom was in a motorcycle collision and had a brain injury, and it was serious. She was in ICU for quite a few days and then hospitalized for a couple weeks. And when I first went in, I mean, seeing your loved one unconscious and in that such a vulnerable state, and then, of course, seeing my dad in that position too, caring for her, that's an experience that will live with me forever. And then seeing her recovery after she was discharged from the hospital, she was in a rehab center for months, about 3 hours from our family home. And so just seeing this years-long process where she went from having conversations with me, sort of conversations where she didn't even remember my name, to then relearning how to walk, how to talk, how to live independently, that was just, it resonated in my heart. And I was young when that happened. And so as I got to be in law and realize what my niche was, I wanted to learn the science so that I could understand her better and understand our experience. And because I was able to live it personally, if I learned the science behind it, then I would be able to help clients in such a better way. That's where the passion came from, is that my own lived experience and wanting to know in depth what she was going through, what my family was going through, so that I could help others similarly situated. And then it's fascinating, right? It's people come with so many different symptoms and so many different types of brain injuries, and their loved ones are dealing with all kinds of deficits that are, again, unique to that person's injury and experience. And so it's so stimulating because it's always progressing and moving, and you're learning just different ways to litigate it, because not every person's brain injury case is the same. So you have to create custom litigation strategies to help that person. And so, but also their treatment plans. I mean, not everybody, it's not a cookie cutter type of injury. And so I find that part fascinating because it's always stimulating and moving, and I'm learning.
It's interesting because probably many of our listeners handle brain injury cases from time to time, but don't have that level of specialization that you have. For those folks who, you know, see a brain injury case, you know, once or twice a year or less maybe, what advice would you give people? What do you think are some of the common mistakes that lawyers make that are kind of general trial lawyers without that focus in handling brain injury cases?
I first would empathize with them because I remember being in that position, and it's overwhelming of where do you start with handling a client who can sometimes be difficult because they're injured in a way that they look normal, but their personalities have changed. So sometimes they're sabotaging their own cases and you don't know what to do. So starting even from there to handling the defense medical exams to what treaters to send them to, it's overwhelming. My advice is to, and what I did, was to reach out initially to people who know. And I reached out to Dorothy Clay Sims, who initially, you know, was and is my mentor, but now is a very, very close friend of mine. And she helped me learn in such a safe space. You know, there's no bad questions. We're going to learn this together. We're going to walk through it together. And with her, I was able to learn the science. And then, of course, she introduced me to some specialists, and then you get to know them, and then you learn more science from those folks. It's almost like a progression, but I started with Dorothy, and I would recommend, it's such a specialized area, and your client deserves the best representation and treatment because they are truly injured and suffering, you got to reach out to folks who know so they can help you and give you the template. And then once you travel this road with someone holding your hand, the next time you go down that road, it's easier. And then the third time you go down that road, you really kind of have an idea of what you're doing. But to do it by yourself the first time without any sort of template is difficult. And I could see where people get frustrated with brain injuries in that process and those clients in that case.
It seems like a lot of times with TBI cases, they get left unnoticed. And a lot of people on the plaintiff side, and then if it's presented on the defense side, really push and say, this is all psychological. It's all in their head. That's emotionally driven, somatoform, anything they can do to drive it away from TBI. Have you dealt with that? And then how do you deal with that in trying to combat it?
I have. And I think that's understanding the science behind it on a cellular level. So you know that this isn't just in their head. They're not just exaggerating or trying to take advantage of a situation. They want to get better. But I think when you realize what happens to the brain on a cellular level, even in a mild, you know, impact or a mild traumatic brain injury, it's real and you can see it. And so what I've tried to do is combat that by getting those objective findings. So, you know, 6 months to a year trying to get them those MRIs and DTIs, but do it with someone who has a specialized machine, not just anybody. It really, because if you go to someone who doesn't have the best DTI MRI machines, then it will come up normal, right? And so that's why we need to know who to go to and those specialties. If, let's say, the MRI DTI is normal, then there's the old adage, absence of proof is not proof of absence. So it just means that we need to find another way to show this. And so, and I'm sure you all know this, but CTE is only shown in an autopsy. It doesn't mean it's not there. You don't see it on an image. It's there and people die from it. So then we go to the next step. What about a functional MRI? Can we show it that way, right? And generally that does help. There's imaging there that would help us show this isn't just a psychological, you're somaticizing. And so then there's hormone dysfunction. What about that? You know, let's get them tested for that. Those are the objective findings that I really go down the rabbit hole to find.
Without getting too nerdy on this, what is the most sensitive type of imaging? There's a particular type of MRI that's used that's sensitive to more subtle changes on a cellular level? And what is that?
Yeah. My understanding is that there's like a 15 Tesla at Stanford. No one can use it yet or something, right? But I believe it's at Stanford. It might be at UCLA, one of the teaching hospitals.
Yeah, I know 10T for sure, 10T. But maybe 15 already now.
No, I think it's, yeah, 10T.
And what does that mean?
That means that the magnet is more powerful so that you're going to see things that you wouldn't see on a 3T, which is regularly used.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So if we're looking at the most specialized machine, it would be the 10T. But it's also the way that you slice and cut the images. And so we're using right now some folks in Michigan that really have done a lot of studies and work and research to slice the imaging in such a way that you can actually see the deficits, right? You can see white matter tracks that are missing. So that's why your experts are so important. But yeah, that's the specialized stuff that I'm referring to. And then after the science, because you need to go down the rabbit hole, at least I do, then after the science, how do we explain that, again, this isn't just in their head? The witnesses are so important. I was listening to y'all's podcast with John Campbell, and it resonated with me, and I believe it's so true. The most credible witnesses are the neutral ones, not the family, not the friends, but the Starbucks barista who said, yeah, this your client used to be able to give me exact change now they can't even count their quarters when I give them change back, right? That guy has no dog in the fight. Those are the folks that we need to look for. And y'all know that. And I'm not saying anything that people don't know, but it's a full picture. And that's how I get around these defense arguments of they're fine. It's a mild traumatic brain injury. They'll get better in 3 months, which we all know is not true. It's multiple components that all have to work and be consistent with each other.
What about the flip side of, you know, you're talking about going down the rabbit hole with all the testing that can become expensive. How do you decide which cases warrant going down the rabbit hole and those where you feel like maybe there just isn't a TBI here and I shouldn't be pursuing it?
I think it's having a lot of conversations with the client. I do spend the money on the clients that I believe are truly injured because I believe them. And so I know that one of those tests, something's going, we're going to find something because I believe you and I believe your wife or your husband. I believe your kids. And so intake is where I try to spend as much time as I can. And if I don't believe that there's something there that I can help someone with, you know, if it's a case that I just don't believe I can help or I would be of any value, I'm not going to take it. And so the cases that I take, I will spend the money and it is very expensive. But my mantra for my firm is justice and healing. And I'm not sending you to folks just to get a diagnosis so that we can win the case so that, you know, I can prove that you're actually injured. It's more than that. I'm going to send you to this specialist who's very expensive because I think they're the only person in the country who can help you get your life back. And it's very important to me.
And are there approaches to treatment that have been effective other than just kind of coping mechanisms or therapies to compensate for the brain injury?
The big one for me lately has been the hormone dysfunction. That's been really great because that's an easier fix. You know, if you've got testosterone deficiencies because your, you know, pituitary gland was injured in the collision, that's injection therapy every 2 weeks and you already feel better. Your fatigue is gone. Your metabolism's better. Your energy is increased. That's my, I hate to say it this way, but that's my favorite when a client will go and get testing by an endocrinologist and they're saying, yeah, your human growth hormone is low. Your testosterone is low. Your whatever. I love that because let's get some injections and let's get this therapy going and they feel better quick. I couldn't ask for something better than that. So that's my ideal situation. Mm. Other things though, yeah, there's medications for focus. There's counseling and therapy that have definitely helped. So yeah, those are the types of therapies I think that get people immediate relief maybe.
Let's talk about some of your more memorable cases. Are there ones that stand out as kind of turning points in your career or just that were particularly meaningful to you or interesting?
Yes, I've got a few. Lately, let's go with most recent. I have been going deep into the rabbit hole of neuropsychology and defense neuropsychology. That is an interesting practice.
You mean borderline criminal and sleazy?
I would take out borderline. And y'all know this, right?
Yeah.
But it is like thrilling for me to go through each and every neuropsych test that's given to my client and seeing the fraud that they perpetuated. And then I now have taken a special interest in the biases to diverse clients that I didn't realize were so blatant.
What's your strategy with the defense neuropsychologist? Are you trying to get them knocked out altogether or just be in a position to exploit their faults when you're crossing them at trial or what?
Case by case basis, but I love exploiting the faults. But making it full circle, you know, the last two neuropsychs that I've deposed, the first one ended abruptly in the middle, which is not unusual, in the middle of the deposition, and he would not continue a second deposition unless I signed a stipulation that I would not accuse him of fraud. And this is after he changed an answer on the MMPI from true to false. And of course, guess which scale, right? When I refused to sign the stipulation, he then sent me a affidavit from his doctor saying that he could no longer participate, not only in this case, but in any case. And he pulled out of all of National General's cases at that time. And we got the policy less than a week later. And then the other one that's most recent, very similar, also committed fraud. She ended the dep in the first session and then refused to appear at trial. And so that's where that case has landed. Those are memorable for me because it shows how far the defense will go to do exactly what Rahul was saying, which is telling your client or telling a jury of their community members that your client is a faker, a fraud, cannot be believed, and was never injured. And that's just, it's bananas. So I get a thrill of like exposing that.
That's fantastic work, because it sounds like that's not helping just your client, but anybody who's affected by this really sleazy expert who's now refusing to work on any case, right?
I think the next step in that is teaching folks, and Dorothy does this already. She, in fact, we presented here, and she teaches folks the experience that your clients go through in the neuropsych assessment. And then you, as the lawyer, get to see, holy smokes, is this really happening? Like, is this what they go through? And these are the types of tests that are being administered to say that my client is a faker or a fraud or a psychopath or schizophrenic or, you know, somaticizer, whatever.
Now, of course, you have to deal with the opposite of that, which is having support for your own neuropsych testing, right? And making sure that that stands up and is subject to cross and all that. So how do you go about dealing with that?
Well, I'm from the school of Dorothy Clay Sims, and we don't hire neuropsychs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So are you using mostly neurologists and neuroradiologists?
Exactly. Behavioral neurologist, physiatrist, and a neuroradiologist. And generally, those folks have multiple specialties. So, you know, the neurologist is generally also the psychiatrist and giving them medication in that way and that type of stuff. So, but that's what we do.
That certainly solves the neuropsych problem.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look. Steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
So what's your philosophy behind not hiring a neuropsych on your cases?
I think, and I have very good friends that are neuropsychologists. In fact, Dorothy and I just went to Portugal to learn from one of them the science. I believe there's absolutely a place for clinical neuropsychology in treating patients. 100%. I believe there is zero place for neuropsychology in a forensic setting, period. Because these defense neuropsychologists they're not using the tests as a piece of a bigger pie to figure out what's going on with this particular patient. They are using the tests in a vacuum and cherry picking certain questions that support their theory that your client is a faker and a fraud. And so what's my philosophy with respect to not using a neuropsych? There's so much fraud committed by the defense that I don't even want to let the defense have an opportunity to look at, you know, the way our neuropsych has tested our client. It doesn't even matter, right? There's so many piss off points with what we've done to their neuropsych. They just lose credibility even bringing these folks to trial.
And how do you accomplish the same goal or function of the neuropsych in your cases relating to testing of your client's, you know, current cognitive functioning and so forth? Is that done by a different expert? Is there still testing, though, that is being done by some other expert, or are you just not doing that type of testing at all?
You're
relying on the objective evidence from imaging, from endocrinology and other sources, plus the reported, you know, clinical history and symptoms and that sort of thing.
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the witnesses.
That makes a lot of sense, really, now that you talk about it, because, I mean, all the testing ultimately is doing, if it is helpful, is validating what everybody already says the person's going through, right? And you can already get that through witnesses.
Exactly.
And then if you can get the before, you can get that through witnesses who knew your client before. And there was never any testing before, which is always one of the criticisms of testing. I like that a lot.
Yeah, Ben.
Very smart.
Exactly.
My big takeaway is, though, if I get a brain injury case, I should just call you.
Yeah, I believe, you know, and going back to my prior answer, I believe there is a place for it when you're treating as part of a bigger picture. But when we're litigating these cases and they're using these tests in such a small way, when you look at these tests, because we go through them each and every question, I go through the reports line by line. Another benefit of not having your own neuropsych is that who are they going to give the raw data to? They have to give it to me. And I obviously have the paperwork, you know, to make sure that that happens. But it's a benefit, and it's helpful to my arguments to the court, that I need the raw data to me directly.
Because they often refuse to give it. I've found that. And they claim it's proprietary, and it's always a battle, right?
Y'all. Again, right? It's like just adding to this dark, clandestine sort of practice of what's happening. But when you actually look at the tests, you'll see that they're not indicative of, frankly, anything. And then if you have a diverse client too, let's look at the normative samples that your client is being compared to. And I can tell you that they don't look like your client. So for example, a gender diverse client, there's zero norms on transgender and gender diverse folks. Zero. That's a freaking problem. So why would I even want my own neuropsych to be testing my diverse client? That doesn't make any sense. The same with minorities. And then you go even further and say, well, how many of these tests were normed on folks taking 2 days of testing, 16 hours sometimes, 8 hours of testing? How many of those folks for each one of these tests actually sat through 8 hours and that's your normative sample? None of them. So that's another reason why I say it. There's really no place for it. Why would I subject my client to that? I mean, they're being compared to people that don't reflect their experience and their prior baseline.
Your approach to brain injury cases, does that mean if there are no objective findings at all that you can't do the case? Or do you just find a different way to do it based on the collection of reported symptoms and problems that the patient or the client has experienced after their brain injury?
You know, I've not yet come across one where there were no objective findings, because I just keep pushing. You know, we just keep pushing. There's hormone tests that you can take to see if someone has PTSD, their levels of cortisol. I mean, there's something we can find that will objectively show this person is injured. You just have to keep pushing and getting them to the folks that can help them find it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, it's kind of validating a thought I've had for years in working with neuropsychologists on our own side, which is that I really don't like it, because it always doesn't feel good. And so I'm happy to hear that there's a different and better approach to this.
Yeah. And then...
Do you guys work with neuropsychs in your brain injury cases, Rahul?
So this is like... this is all resonating with me because I'm not a fan of litigation-based medicine, right? But at the same time, there's a lot of neurologists as part of their treatment modalities when they're examining a patient who has subjective complaints that are consistent with the TBI. First thing they do is say, let's get an MRI done, right? Because that's part of their knowledge base. And I don't have any criticism of that. And then on the other side with the subjective complaints, they say, I want neuropsych testing done. And then they'll ask for the neuropsych testing to be done in a treatment plan, not in a litigation plan. And so if the doctors are following their normal methodology in treating a TBI or identifying and diagnosing it, I don't have a problem with it. But if it's a, hey, I want to order a neuropsych examination so that I can put together some sort of body of evidence, that's where I start to struggle with it. And I don't find that to be savory at all. So I guess the short answer is yes, I use them when the experts are saying they want a neuropsych. No, I don't use them by my own volition. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we switch gears a little bit? And I'm interested in your decision because, as you may or may not know, I recently left a law firm myself to start my own firm. And that was a big life decision. And I know you just went through that recently yourself. Can you tell us kind of how you came to that and how it's been? You're how many months or so into this are you?
Two months?
Yeah, that's
a little less
wow.
than two.
Oh, so you're still in the... You wake up at 2 a.m. in a cold sweat phase.
I'm so glad you're saying it because I didn't know. I have nightmares, you know, it's heavy and you're carrying a lot of responsibility and there's anxiety. I've never really experienced anxiety to this extent before, but I have it.
I was right there 2 years ago. I mean, probably for 3 months, I woke up in the middle of the night every night thinking, I'm going to lose my house. I'm not going to be able to pay for my kids to go to college. What the hell did I just do? I get it, but yeah. I'm 2 years into it now, and it's probably the best decision I ever made. So just stick with it.
Thank you.
It'll work out for you. But
thanks for saying that.
But it takes a lot of courage to do that. You were at a very successful firm. You had a lot of success there. Tell us why you made that leap.
I did, and I have a lot of appreciation for that experience with that firm, the great folks. And I wanted to specialize. I wanted fewer cases so that I could give those cases all of my attention. And because that's the part of the practice, getting to know my clients and what they need, bearing witness to what they're going through, that's what energizes me. And so I wanted to be able to create a practice where that was my main focus. And so I have few cases, but I give all of my attention to those folks, and the few cases is on purpose for that reason. Also, I've got a personal experience. Before I met my husband and daughter, they experienced a very profound loss. My husband lost his wife, and my daughter lost her mom when she was 4 in a collision. And it went to trial. And so they have that experience of going, and, you know, I didn't know them. I didn't represent them or anything. This was completely aside from me and before my time. But they have the experience of going through this entire process, right? And so I get to know my clients. They get to know my family and my kids. And they do have an opportunity to talk to my husband about this very shared, awkward, strange experience of being in front of a jury of people who are looking at you like, are you telling the truth? Who are you really? You know, did you really have that kind of relationship with the person that you lost? What a strange experience. And so the other side to that is my beautiful daughter and my husband. When the lawyer leaves the case, the client is still dealing with what has happened to them. And that is a reminder for me every day that what they've gone through, it never goes away. And so that makes me fight even harder so that they know they got justice for that, because this is a lifetime of something that our clients have to deal with. And so I wanted to create a practice that brought that type of empathy, this type of conversation with my family and my clients that would make them feel better about the process. And I wanted to also specialize in the brain injury portion of it. And I thought it would be best if I did that on my own. So that's what we've done. And it's a very, you know, my family is 100% invested. My husband's like printing shirts with the O Firm on it. It's just the most beautiful thing, right? And it's just, it adds to my anxiety a little bit, because I'm like, I need everyone to...
Can I ask you about, so you get the unique vantage point of seeing us, our profession, through the eyes of somebody who is not one of us, but has had to live it and rely on lawyers to handle their case and go through the whole process. Sounds like did they go to trial?
Yeah, to verdict.
And what have you learned from that? How did they experience the process from their perspective? Did they get a good result? And yeah. What is their lasting impression of that?
My husband is, man, he's such a social, cool, beautiful person. And it was absolutely jarring to him to have to justify his relationship and his family to 12 people he's never even seen before. And to do it three and a half years after the loss too is really strange. In his case, trial didn't happen, you know, immediately. And so you're reliving something years and years later. And you're trying to be your most vulnerable in front of people you don't know. What a strange experience. And so I take that and empathize with my clients that this isn't right. This isn't normal. You shouldn't have to justify yourself. But I'm here. I'm going to walk you through it. We're going to do it together. You know, I think Aaron is my husband. I think it's cathartic to some extent too for him to help people, because he's a healer also. And so for him to help people who are going through that process, I think it's cathartic for him. And then from the perspective of my girl.
How you said she was 4 when she lost her mom. 4 is old enough that you would understand what happened there.
I think so. But I also think that folks block things out. And so there's a little bit of that also. You know, what's interesting too is as I'm getting more into PTSD, I'm realizing that there's a crossover here too. And that's really interesting for me. And so in our own family, once I realized that, we're working on that with therapists and things like that too. And so it reminds me from her perspective that this is ongoing. This is a lifetime. It does get triggered at certain moments. You know, I'm sure her 16th birthday, when she gets married, when she has her first kids, these are things that are, it's going to come up. And it just is a reminder for me that my clients are still living their lives in the way that this defendant left them, even after I leave. And that's profound and gives me a lot of courage to get them the justice they deserve.
What are you teaching here at the Trial University, I guess we call it, right?
We don't know if you saw the blurb, but it was pretty good. It was Dorothy's, but the name of our presentation is called Walk Away Pissed. And so without giving too much information, we give the attorneys the experience that their client has during the assessment. So if your clients are answering certain questions, one, we kind of do a little bit of dive into that. So for example, and a lot of this is public information, there's been articles that have published like the MMPI questions. But for example, there's questions like, I like to dance. Oh, okay. Well, what's that an indication of, right?
Is that a yes or no?
Yeah, true, false. Yeah, true, false. I can't remember which scale it goes to, but it's, and then other
true,
questions.
True, but I'm very bad at it. How about you?
It's no, and I'm really bad at it.
But But then, and I wonder, I think it's, I like to dance or I like to go to dances. And so how many dudes
yeah, what
do
does
we know?
That, what does that test?
Right. Exactly. We went over it yesterday, but it's like, I can't remember the scale, but it's absurd. Or another one is, I love my dad, my father. And if my father died, I loved my father. Seriously? And if my memory serves, that's a point. If you answer false to that, that's a point for malingering and lying. Oh, okay. So if your dad was a complete psychopath and, you know, and you don't love him because he's crazy, you're a liar on that particular test. If you do a deep dive on
but
these
also,
tests.
Also, why would somebody lie about that? I don't understand.
Right.
Wouldn't you be inclined if you were trying to game the test and thinking, I should answer it the right way? You would say, yes, I love my dad, even though he was an alcoholic and he was abusive my whole life. I don't want to disclose that, so I'm going to put yes. If you're going to lie, you're going to lie in the yes direction, right?
Because you're trying to make yourself look better. But I think in this, I can't get behind what these folks are thinking at all. And by the way, these tests were created years and years ago. But I think what they're trying to say, maybe say, is if you're trying to show deficit, like you're trying to say something's wrong, then you would maybe put false on that and you're lying.
Because everyone loves their dad, at least in my family.
But then, oh, yeah.
100% true.
But then there's so many other crazy questions on there. And it was recently revamped, but whatever that means. And so one of the questions like on the MMPI-2RF is, I love law enforcement. You don't think that's biased to some diverse clients? What are you talking about? One of the questions is, I like being a girl. And I think it's something about, I like being a girl. And I've always liked being a girl or something to that effect. And it's like, what is that even supposed to mean, right?
And then what's the point scale? So if you say false, does that mean you're a malingerer
yeah,
and a liar?
You get a point on a scale, and if I don't have it in front of me, but you do get a point on the scale of some sort of psychopathy. And you're like, what are you talking about? And heaven forbid you're a gender diverse client. Now what does that mean for you, right?
When you cross-examine their neuropsych, do you go through these questions and say, why does that matter? And
I do.
And do they? Can anybody answer these questions in a way that makes any sense?
I don't know.
They don't even know what's on the test, probably, right?
That's
they just
right.
administer it, and they know what the point score is. And
they don't even administer it.
They
get
some...
a psychometrician to do it.
Right.
Right? And those steps are fun.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it's an interesting, if you go down the rabbit hole. So for example, the TOM test, that's a test of malingering. The test requires, the manual requires that the pictures are shown for 3 seconds and a second break, then 3 seconds, second break. And then between the trials, there is a delay of about 10 minutes. Do you think that the defense neuropsych shows the objects for 3 seconds or 1 second?
One.
Do you think right? Do you think that the delay is appropriately timed per the instructions of the manual? Come on,
Raul can take this one,
right? And that's why too. I would love for someone who has a brain injury case to reach out, because that's why these things need to be audio taped. If we can, let's get them videotaped. Many jurisdictions don't allow it, but that's something I would love to start working on too. Is getting that changed, because we can time the TOM test and we can figure out if they did it properly. There's a lot of things that we can do. So, but a person who hasn't yet litigated a brain injury case may not know that. And so it's really important just to reach out to me, to Dottie, to someone that they trust who can walk them through that process so that we can show the fraud, because it's there.
Well, this has been really fascinating. We've come to the end of our hour. But if folks do want to reach out to you, they have questions, are you willing to receive those? And if so, how do people get in touch with you?
I'm so willing, to help in any way that I can. I think we all get such a joy out of teaching and helping, which is why we're here at TLU. So my website is theortegafirm.com. And my email is Tanya, T-A-N-Y-A, at theortegafirm.com. And then, and part of my firm also, you know, Dorothy and Dr. Oregon Hunter, who's a physiatrist who often works with Dorothy, they're both consultants at our firm. So, you know, you get us all as a package deal. And that's for every case, every client, every attorney who needs help. So just, we're here. We want to help. We want to, the more that we can publicize and expose and show some of these frauds that are happening to our clients, and not just our clients, but folks who have, you know, their freedom at stake in criminal cases, you know, their family is at stake in family law cases. And this is a high stakes game. So the more that we can help, we're there. We want to. So please reach out.
We will. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tanya.
Oh, you guys, this has been awesome. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate
Thanks for
inviting me and everything y'all are doing in our practice too. I look up to y'all. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.